Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager of the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for attending today. We're going to look at budgies today and sort of common diseases that we see or common reasons that they would present into a first opinion clinic, really. And I think we need to sort of just very briefly sort of just have a think about where budgies come from, as it were. And I suppose the first point to be aware of is that they are quite low value citizens. So this basically means that they're bred in quite large numbers, either in the UK primarily by people breeding them for exhibition, and it is the leftover birds from that that enter into the pet trade, or it may be somebody breeding large numbers specifically for the purposes for the pet trade. And certainly a lot of the more exhibition breeders will breed budgies of very attractive colours alongside their show stock, as it were, to raise funds, really, I guess. And there's also quite a lot of budgie import from continental Europe, from over Eastern Europe, coming through into the UK. So when you've got these birds coming out of the exhibition fancy, where these birds are being exchanged and exhibited and mixed, or being bred for the trade, or going through traders, going through retailers, there basically is a lot of mixing of budgies throughout through Europe, really, before they enter into the pet trade. This basically means there are a number of fairly common endemic infections that we see quite commonly in the pet budgies, and even having a bird isolated as an individual in the pet environment, you know, these infectious diseases are still relevant to a bird in that circumstance. And of course, any owner of a new animal from the pet shop, I guess they expect it to be free of disease and healthy, but of course we know that they're not. And this goes back to somebody, you know, acquiring a dog, they expect to be vaccinated, but you know, if it's got worms, well, all puppies have worms. But if you're in the circumstance that there was another infectious disease, it would be quite concerned about that. So I guess it's trying to work out what are reasonable infections that we would expect to see in the pet trade coming from the pet supply that maybe they can do very limited things about given the circumstances, which you wouldn't blame them necessarily for passing on in the bird. I appreciate that's not less than ideal, but nevertheless that is the real situation. So if you think about how infectious diseases are going to be spread through this population of budgies, really you've got bird-to-bird transmission, which we're going to see, direct physical contact through drops in the environment, feather dust, things like this, contamination of the environment with feces. But you're also going to see this with indirect transmission from seed, utensils, footwear, clothing, really any pet shop that houses birds in the pet shop which are exposed in the same airspace to all their dry goods they are selling in terms of cages and food and whatever else they're buying or toys, then obviously that feather dust or that fecal contamination from the birds in the pet shop or from the birds that are being held in that storeroom, if it's an online store you're getting things from, they can put infective material over all of those items. So any pet budgie is at risk of being exposed to infective material simply because of feather dust transfer. And I guess this is in contrast, you know, if you were looking at somebody buying a grey parrot, for example, where we are concerned about things like citizen beak and feather disease, then those are artificially incubated behind a separate airspace with staff that are, you know, changing their clothes, coming in, they're being hand-reared, kept separate from everybody else, and then they maybe are being screened for beak and feather disease, screened for psittacosis and things prior to sale. A lot of these are sold in a separate section behind glass to other more common citizens. And so with a lot of the larger parrots, when they do come home, they probably have been in isolation or been some form of quarantine before coming home as an individual house pet. When you're looking at low value citizens, it's not worth doing hand rearing of these, separate airspaces, having proper quarantine facilities in place. And indeed, the cost of screening for these diseases far outweighs the economic value of the bird itself. So it's low value, and you get what you pay for, really, if that makes sense. And that's why the budgies are completely different to how you'd get a larger citizen coming through. And the fact is, we can't trust the pet shops and breeders. We don't know they're disease free, and just because they haven't bothered looking for it doesn't mean to say it's not present. And certainly a lot of breeders of the lower economic citizens will accept a higher mortality and morbidity than you would ever consider acceptable for the larger citizens, because they're of low economic value, it has less of an economic impact. So if we're looking at trying to prevent disease in these, that's quite difficult for the supplier, the retailer, the pet shop owner. It's impossible, because your origin of the birds are questionable, hand rearing is not practical or economic, and they've been mixed repetitively before they've gone to the pet owner. So much as you might have an individual bird coming to the pet owner, that bird has been mixed and matched with all sorts of birds before it's got to that point. And quarantining, screening for diseases is something that is unlikely to have hit anybody's radar prior to this bird being sold to the owner, who's then brought it to you for a post-purchase health check, let's suggest. Now, okay, most pet birds that are bought at this circumstance will then be moved into isolation. And it may be this is a budgie house on its own, but of course it might be a bird that's brought into a group of another three or four birds who again would have come from that same background. But obviously, what diseases they bring with them is the diseases they bring, and unless this owner is regularly going to the pet shop and acquiring new birds or contaminating themselves with infective feather dust, then obviously new diseases coming in may be less likely. And so you could say, okay, if I've got this bird, I know it's come from an awful background, but that's how it happens. And maybe now I'm going to screen this bird and treat this bird. It's economically viable now because this is a much loved pet. And maybe I can do some good by looking and seeing what's going on at this point. And obviously, if you get the opportunity to encourage an owner to get their new bird to go into quarantine for a little bit, separate from the other birds, in a separate room where they are going to go in and feed that bird and look after that bird after their main birds, then maybe you can screen to make sure there's nothing that's going to come in to the existing group that is there. But bear in mind, of course, we've no idea what that existing group is carrying, because that owner will not have thought about screening or testing for that group either. So if you want to try and do right, get your bird in a separate cage, put it in a separate room, feed it after everybody else, make sure it's eating, make sure it's drinking, make sure the feces are passing, are coming through looking normally. Is it holding its body condition? Is it behaving normally? And these are all good things that may make you feel happier that this bird is certainly clinically well, at least, prior to introduction to the group. And because the feather dust is so infective, then we do need to try and do some damage limitation in terms of risk of spread of disease, both at the point of sale at the pet shops, but equally at home as well. And you want to get the right disinfectant that has the ability to work and do what you want to do. And for most people, when they're disinfecting whilst they're cleaning, and that's actually not what you want to do. You need to have spotlessly clean environment such that then you can disinfect the clean surface. And obviously having the correct dilution and the correct contact time is quite important. One of the safest disinfectants we recommend for routine use will be the F10, and we do know this is effective against the beak and feather disease and polyoma as well, which we'll come on to a little bit later, as control. So a lot of people will use this for routine cleaning, and immediately prior to cleaning the bird out, you can use this and mist this over the bottom of the cage to limit feather dust from being generated into the air, to try and limit the effects on, I guess, human health in terms of feather dust contamination and things like psittacosis, which again we'll talk about. But also obviously it means it's less infective material being spread around from the bird's point of view as well. And there's probably three, maybe four infections that we need to be considering here that are all decidedly possible as appearing in an individual pet budgie. First one being Macrorhabdus, which is avian gastric yeast, or known as megabacteria as well. Second being psittacosis or chlamydophila. Third is citizine beacon feather disease. And Trichomonas maybe is on your list, but much less of an issue in these days, really. If we look at Macrorhabdus first, this is megabacteria. It's transmitted from bird to bird in the feces. And this is basically avian gastric yeast. They ingest it. It causes more a chronic standing disease that affects the GI tract, and you can get, they can lose body condition, they can start regurgitating or vomiting seeds back, they might pass seeds in the feces, occasionally they can bleed. This can invade the mucosa of the proventriculus and lead to an acute bleed and death. Now, you can screen for this condition. You can use fecal samples, crop smears, which we'll come on to that in due course, to screen for this infection. You can use it as a very, very simple DiffQuick in-house to identify and see if it is present. If it is present, it doesn't mean to say it's going to be causing clinical disease in that bird at that time or ever. And if it's not present, you might have missed it and it's been intermittently shed. Now, the classical sort of age group where we're seeing this cause a problem is generally about 8 months of age. So a lot of your baby birds that have been purchased, we bought, be absolutely fine, nothing wrong with them, and you'll start seeing clinical signs of this disease developing from 8 months of age onwards. So normally it's quite some significant time post-purchase before you start seeing clinical signs. And the bird may simply just be just a little bit, I suppose soft is the word a lot of people would use, the breeders would certainly use. We've got a slightly sleepy looking eye, body condition and weight has just dropped back ever so slightly, but that might be all you're seeing. We're obviously concerned with the preventriculus if you end up doing a PM, and it's the preventricular mucosa here that we want to be scraping, putting under DiffQuick, and this is sort of classical Macrorhabdus or megabacteria sort of gram variable rods that you would see, maybe more gram positive than negative if you're going to gram stain as opposed to DiffQuick, but classical, and you'll see these causing a big mat on the cytology. And if you do histopath, then you'll see chronic preventricular inflammatory changes going on and disease in there. So screening, doing fecal screens, crop washes and things that are sensible, and then you may even consider routine prophylactic treatment of birds for this condition, and certainly a lot of the breeders will be doing this once or twice a year. Originally we used to use amphotericin B, which was Megaback S, which was imported from Australia. There used to be other liquid equivalents that you could use, but really as a thrush treatment now, amphotericin has kind of faded back in the human market, and so it's quite difficult to get suitable formulations of amphotericin that you can use in the birds. So now a lot of people are reaching for sodium benzoate. Sodium benzoate is a fungistatic food additive that you use as a preservative. You can buy it over the internet perfectly fine. It's not a prescription product. It's just a food additive, and you sort of add about half a gram of this per liter of drinking water to the birds. Very fine line is being drawn on the dosage of this, because if the birds are consuming a lot of water or you're pushing the dose too high, you can get toxicity with the sodium benzoate, and neurological signs are quite commonly seen. So just be cautious if you're going to recommend routine treatment. Make sure it's out of the breeding season and the bird isn't kept too hot. But basically people will be doing that sort of, you know, for a week, 10 days in the water once or twice a year, aiming to try and limit the overgrowth of the Macrorhabdus in the stomach of the bird. Other options you can consider, which people have used as well, are things like the F10, 1 in 1,000 dilution used in the drinking water, again designed to try and cut down fungal growth or the yeast overgrowth. in the bird's stomach. Chlamydophila is next on our list, and this again is significant. A common citrazine problem, but also birds of prey, pigeons and things as well. And this obviously can pass to people, so we do need to be aware of this. Your classical signs for chlamydophila are going to be respiratory signs, so conjunctivitis, sinusitis, nasal discharges, green watery feces maybe coming through due to liver damage, and basically, if you look at a bunch of budgies, a budgie breeder, for example, who's got 50 or 100 birds sitting at home, they probably have psittacosis within that group. And when the birds get stressed, immunosuppressed, then you may start clinical signs occurring. And really, any pet budgie coming through with respiratory signs, whether it be sinusitis, which we've got here, very quite classical sinusitis causing quite a marked ocular discharge here, maybe a little bit of feather staining above the beak here as well. You put psittacosis on your list for this one. Now, okay, you might see other causes for this in terms of other bugs going through, maybe mycoplasma, maybe other resistant gram-negatives as well, but you should always be thinking that psittacosis is on your list for these sort of cases. Now, depending how concerned you're going to get about psittacosis, some people will routinely screen every citrazine before it goes into the clinic. They're just like, we're just going to test for it now. And you can get speed clam, which are just little ELISA tests you can use on feces as a quick guide. PCR really is being sent away to one of the commercial labs is the gold standard. But you can also do antibodies and things as well for this. So any of these cases, start thinking about it. This is just some more views here. This is the budgie, grey budgie you've just seen here, and this discharge here, again, is consistent with a sinus discharge coming out of the nares. But also on this bird here, you've now seen this discharge become so thickened, we actually have a blocked nares on both sides, actually, here. This bird won't be showing any signs of dyspnea. It will just mouth breathe, but you will obviously see that. More conjunctivitis cases here, again, just making the point, you know, this is something else that worries you. And you may get polyuria with green staining of feces as well coming through on the birds, and that's something else that should also be worrying you. So you might be suspicious based on your clinical signs. That might set alarm bells ringing, and you're thinking, okay, this is what I need to be aware of. It may be this is something you flag up to the owner instantly at that point, and send them home with sort of basically a fact sheet in terms of the risks of human signs from chlamydophila, which are going to be flu-like symptoms, headaches, things like that if they get exposed to it. And obviously, if you're looking at PCR or fecal ELISAs, if this bird has had previous treatment, then you may end up with a negative result because the treatment will stop the bird from shedding the psittacosis. That in itself isn't necessarily a bad thing. If you've got one of these birds coming in and you're very suspicious of psittacosis and you're going to start barrier nursing, then obviously once you start treatment, if you stop the shedding fairly quickly, the risk factor of that bird transmitting it to staff or to other birds starts to reduce down having done that. So that's a good thing. And obviously these really ought to be housed in separate units, negative pressure air ventilation to keep them separate. And thankfully, because most budgies are brought in their small cages, these will normally fit into these units quite nicely. Now, if you're suspicious or you're testing, what do you do while you're waiting? Then really, your best treatment would be to use injectable doxycycline once a week for 6 weeks to limit the shedding of this organism. And the reason you're going for a six-week period is in order to stop the transmission of this bug through the macrophages in the white cells of the bird. So the infective stage basically hides in the white cells, and as it moves between infective cells in the white cells, that's when it is susceptible to the doxycycline. When it's intracellular, the doxycycline has difficulty dealing with that. So we treat for the expected lifespan of a bird's monocyte, aiming to try and catch all of the particles in between treatment. What you'll find, of course, is you enter, if you do that, you get a negative PCR samples afterwards because you stop the shedding, and you might see that for up to 3 weeks after the course of treatment. But of course, the bird is then in a position to reactivate the infection if you haven't cleared it completely, and the chance of you clearing it would be quite remote in terms of complete elimination, at which point it could reactivate and start shedding again 3 weeks later, 3 months later, 3 years later, or never, depending on what the bird decides to do. So you could consider rescreening on a PCR again afterwards to ensure that the bird has stopped shedding at that time, and I would, like I say, time that probably 3 weeks after you've completed treatment. But you just have to be aware to the owners that it could reactivate at any time point should it decide to. Your second choice for this is you can go for water-soluble doxycycline, of which you've got Ornicure, but there are also now a water-soluble effervescent doxycycline tablets you can get. That will also work for you as an alternative if the owner is unable to inject it or you don't have the doxycycline injection available. And for that, you need to get the special treatment authorization from the VMD to get it imported. It's not licensed in the UK as a product. And again, if you're looking at these and you're thinking, okay, I've got a sinus infection, I've got a conjunctivitis, and I'm not that concerned about psittacosis, then you could broaden that right out and say, okay, let's treat resistant gram-negatives, let's treat mycoplasma as well, at which point you need to make sure you're choosing the right sort of products. So if you're looking at that, for example, if you're looking at another antibiotic already to give, then you're probably going to be reaching for your N-rifloxacin. Flagyl's just here to extend the spectrum to anaerobic if you wanted to, but basically N-rifloxacin is fine. In terms of eye drops, depending what eye drops you've got, obviously we'll see a lot of resistant gram-negatives that things like gentamicin, for example, like the Tiocil here, will be very effective against, which is lovely. But bear in mind your aminoglycosides have no antimicroplasmal activity. Fustic acid has no antimicroplasmal activity either and is no good against resistant gram-negatives. So you're kind of forced, if you're going to go for topical eye treatment for these, really more down the route of using chloramphenicol or a fluoroquinolone eye drop like Exocin, Ofloxacin or Ciprofloxacin, both of which are human drugs available, to try and cover the base for mycoplasma and maybe have a bit of a nod towards Chlamydophila as well, obviously, because Baitrol can prevent the shedding of Chlamydophila too. So Baitrol and N-rifloxacin or equivalent eye drops aren't so bad if this is the way you went to go. And I suppose at least for the Baitrol, you can directly gavage it or give them to it orally, which then means you're trying to at least get a bit more of a chance that you're guaranteeing that these birds are getting the treatment. And if you've got one with clinical signs and the rest haven't, I still would be treating the entire group. I would be doing the whole group of budgies and all other cytosines present in the household. The other common disease that you're going to see coming through into the pet trade really is French molt. Now, French molt is a very common breeder problem. It's basically Circa virus or PBFD plus or minus polyoma virus involved. It's transmitted in feather dust, vertical transmission from parents to offspring as well. And this causes, primarily in the young birds, some you can get acute death as tiny babies, but once you get to sort of 3-4 weeks of age, it can start causing feather dystrophy, primarily affecting the wings and tail, but also body feathers as well. And at this stage, a lot of those birds will be kept by the breeder. Some may spontaneously recover enough to fly and regain some feather regrowth, and others won't. And obviously, stocking density and hygiene and how well they're controlling effective feather dust in the environment is a factor here as well. And because it's vertically transmitted, it's vertically impossible to get negative birds from this. Now, if the birds, obviously a lot of birds sold in pet shops will be positive for these agents and may be subclinically infected and never cause a problem. And normally, if you haven't had marked clinical signs as a youngster, then you very rarely see it causing a problem as adults. But what you do get is you can get some birds that will be weaned around the 5.5-6 weeks of age and will be absolutely fine at weaning. They'll move into the pet shop and be okay, but they'll then start shedding their feathers after that time point, around the sort of 8, 10, maybe 12 weeks of age. And some birds that then go through their first molt from being what we call a bar head, when they've got the bars over their head, growing into mature feathers at 12 weeks of age, some of those at that time point will also have feather difficulty. So you might have some owners that have bought a bird that was flying fine at the time of purchase, but then present to you within a few weeks saying, oh, it's now unable to fly, it's lost a few feathers. And that there's a distinct possibility that may be beacon feather disease as opposed to just a molt or losing feathers for some other reason. So bear this in mind. This is something you will see in that age group of recently purchased pet budgies. And the final disease that we're concerned about, maybe you're seeing less of these days, is trichomonas, which can cause vomiting and regurgitation in the budgies as well. We can use a crop wash to look for this, and obviously vomiting and regurgitation is quite a common clinical sign. I'm kind of putting them all together at this time point, really, in that we do see that due to the Macrorhabdus, as we've mentioned. We'll see it due to Trichomonas, which we're mentioning at the minute, but you'll also see it due to other things like Candida and yeast or other things going on. So a crop wash is actually quite a common clinical technique we'll be using in the budgies to try and identify under causes for why are you vomiting or regurgitating. The slight difference between these two clinical signs is regurgitation is normally a pleasurable experience directed to an object. In other words, part of mating behavior. Vomiting is when the bird is involuntarily expelling crop contents, normally flicking them around and getting almost like the vomit stuck over its face because it's not enjoying the experience. So if you're going to do a crop wash, this cadaver here is just basically showing you a crop needle that's passed down into the crop. They have a bobble on the end that you can feel. Trachea, the glottis is quite narrow. It's impossible to accidentally intubate a budgie with one of these tubes with a bobble on like this. And if you're doing it single-handed as I'm doing here, you've got the tube feeding in, your wash fluid, so maybe this is some Hartmann's, warmed Hartmann's going in here. This finger here is feeling that bobble in the crop as I'm doing it. And this finger is just holding, obviously, the bird still. So I can feel this, palpate, know I'm in the right position, instill some fluid, massage the crop around, aspirate back on the syringe. That can then go on to a glass slide. And then what we're looking for, as you can see in the lower image here, we're looking for signs of motility and basically the flagellated protozoa, which is what Trichomonas is, running around on that slide. And we've got a little video we're going to show you next of that coming up. This is a classical sort of clinical sign of a bird with Trichomonas, and what we've got here is vomiting material being stuck and matted around the beak as this bird is regurgitating crop contents. And we're going to use a crop wash to try and work out which bugs are potentially involved in that bird. But what you want to do for your Trichomonas is to basically get this preparation straight onto a slide. Within 30 minutes you want to be looking for motility on your wet preparation here, just under a wet prep, and you can see here quite nicely on the video we've got running here, you've got motility going straight away on there. This confirms your diagnosis of flagellates in the crop. This is Trichomonas, and this is where you're reaching for your metronidazole. In this case, it works perfectly fine as antiprotozoa for these guys. But you can also get ronidazole, which you can put in water as well for them as well. But metronidazole really is your first line choice for these. And again, I will be treating the group if this is present. As we seem to have moved quite stealthily onto parasitic infections, there are also a few parasitic infections that we will see coming through onto the pet budgies as well. Scaly face is one which is very common in the trade in birds as well, and you can get birds that are bought into the pet shop showing very subtle signs of disease that progressively develop scaly face post-purchase. Some of them will be sold with minor signs of scaly face, and the pet shop won't even notice they're selling them with it. You'll see red mites, maybe less common, but still a very common pathogen in the birds, on canaries and the budgies particularly. So again, depending on how many birds are being swapped and changed around in the pet shop, what sort of species they're housing, you may get some red mites being present. And I put randoms on here just as an aside, much less common these days, but you may see them. But if you're routinely looking at doing fecal or wet preparations, for example, for Macrorhabdus, then obviously if there's worm eggs there, you're going to pick them up. And most of these are ascarids that we're dealing with here. And ascarid eggs look like ascarid red eggs and are fairly obvious. So your scaly face, your clinical signs you're going to get here, is pretty much as described, really. This is Nematocoptes pilei. And you're going to get scaliness coming over the cere, creeping down over the beak, severe cases involving eyes as well. And you can obviously get beak abnormalities with this, pushing down into extensive changes over the legs as well. Very, very pruritic. And if you take a little scraping of these, you get the classical Nematocoptes mites on your cytology preparation to confirm your diagnosis. But this is classical clinically, and a lot of people will be just treating. They won't be diagnosing this because clinically it's so obvious. Your red mites are obviously motile and live off the host, but can come onto the host to suck blood. These, you'll find great swathes of these in the bird's environment, more than perhaps on the bird themselves. They're photophobic, so during the day they're hidden away. It's normally at night you'll start seeing these coming out. And they would normally hide in around the nooks and crannies of the cage. This might be at the ends of the perches, between the perches and the bars, for example. Or if you've got perches with little plastic caps over the wood, in at that little point, you might see them hiding in there. You might see them around by the drinkers, where the cage fits onto the plastic base, underneath the paper on the floor, in amongst the toys. You'll very rarely see them running around free, as it were. So if you're ever concerned you might have mites present, take the perches out and disassemble them. Disassemble bits of the cage. And if you run your finger through there, you know, if you're squashing these, you'll get fresh blood straight away. You'll get a red streak coming through. But obviously you can also do sellotape strips and things and pick them up and find them that way. So, you know, we do see an issue with both of these. A lot of the breeders will routinely treat. A lot of the pet shops may routinely treat. And certainly there are lots of pet products out there that you can use. I suppose the depending where you go from, the anti-mite, a lot of these are pyrethrum-based or permethrin-based products you can get from the pet shop, used routinely. The xeno obviously is marketed. You've probably got it in the clinic already, which is an ivermectin specifically marketed for this purpose. Works very well against the scaly face and the red mites. Ivermec injection, if you must, but obviously with the small birds, we're more cautious. But fipronil spray works really great as well against these, both on the bird and in the environment as well. And what some people will do is they'll spray a little bit of fipronil onto the end of a cotton bud, and they might actually directly apply this onto the scaly face lesions around the beak and on the feet to directly have an effect against them as well. And for red mites, you might put a little bit of front line directly onto the skin underneath the bird's wings to have an effect on that. So all of these, I guess, series of provisos aside of what things these poor people might be inadvertently inheriting with their bird, are things that you need to be aware of to obviously be routinely looking for or screening for or having on your treatment list if you're going to try some treatment before you progress any further. Now, that aside, obviously, depending on why the bird is presented to you, you know, clearly getting a decent clinical history on this bird, where it's come from, how long have they had it, does it live with any other birds, has it been sick, how long has it been sick, what do you feed it, what is the cage like, which room of the house is it in, all those standard sort of history taking questions to try and get a feel for how this bird is kept and what may be leading to the reason for presentation is quite important. And obviously looking at the bird at a distance is great, so we can see how the bird is doing, and obviously checking weight and body condition score is relevant. The beauty of birds is most birds weigh what birds weigh, so you're in a position that you can kind of predict what weight the budgie should be. But with the, I suppose, development more of exhibition style budgies, you may get birds that come in that weigh anywhere between 25 and 50 odd grams. I think probably most birds, UK bred birds in the pet trade, maybe are in the 40 gram mark, but there is quite a current enthusiasm for a large number of Eastern European birds coming in, and some of those are down about 25 grams and are still in good body condition. So you get a little bit of variability. But of course, it's the keel, which you've seen on this dead bird here, ready for PM. You can see how the muscle is wasted here, so you've got to feel that body condition to decide if that's okay. But obviously, once you know the weight of the individual bird, it's going to stay that weight pretty much. That's the way it's going to be. You're not going to get massive weight variation over the lifespan of that bird. If they're showing any signs of dyspnea, difficulty breathing, straight away for careful handling. If you're happy, then okay, you can do a brief clinical assessment of the patient to see what's going on. And obviously, when you're looking at these behaving in the cage before you handle them, they want to be bright, eyes, clear of swelling or discharge, flying around, an even coloured sear, no discharge from there. Body condition should be okay, but not fat and not thin when you're feeding the keel. The vent should be nice and dry and clear of any discharges. And they should be tight feathered. And what we're talking about tight feathered is the feathers should be flat against the body, really. A bird that is fluffing itself out like this bird is, for example, here that we just sort of let and have a sit down on the sink in the consult room. This bird is fluffing itself out. It's trying to conserve heat in the environment. It shouldn't do that. And this basically is a bird that is sick. It's conserving energy. This is a bird that needs to be hospitalized based on clinical assessment. And again, we're looking for tail bobbing for signs of respiratory distress. So if they're putting lots of physical exertion into breathing, or the tail's moving a lot, or their mouth breathing or making noise, that's of concern. That says, you know, this bird is going to have to come in. This bird has a respiratory changes going on. And again, we do see that quite commonly as well. And we do get problems with nutrition in these guys as well, depending on what diet you've just had this information relayed to you. Iodine maybe is a bit of an older problem these days, but we do still see the odd case where we're seeing goiter related due to iodine deficiency. But a lot of birds will have iodine nibbles being presented to compensate for that to some extent in their cage as well. That's a little pink blocks that you'll see stuck on the side. Other things that we do see on diet-wise will be high protein, so you get rapid beak and nail growth. We certainly get some calcium deficiencies maybe, and vitamin A deficiencies longer term. And obviously obesity due to high fat content in food is something we'll see quite regularly as well. So a whole range of dietary reasons you might be seeing in these birds, and if they're coming in for a post-purchase check, then maybe this is an opportunity for you to consider getting onto a better diet long term, maybe adding in some fruit and veg, maybe getting them on egg food or switching to a pelleted diet, the likes of Harrison's, for example, to try and persuade these people to get them onto a better diet longer term. Other common reasons they'll come into, I guess, at post-purchase will be due to beak and nail overgrowth, which we tend to use just fairly standard nail clippers to deal with. Ring binding is one that's worthwhile putting at you just as an aside for today, in that a lot of them coming from the breeders will come with a closed ring. And this is put onto the bird at a very young age, maybe sort of 6 days of age, to confirm the breeder and the year of year they were born. But if you get any changes going on down here in terms of thickened scales forming, or material impacting down, or maybe you're getting gout, or this gets stuck somewhere, you obviously can get trauma to the leg as a consequence. Now, thankfully, the budgie rings aren't that strong. You will want a decent pair of nail clippers, and ideally, nail clippers are fine with a spring mechanism. You can gradually apply pressure, gently holding the leg and the ring together to break this, and then it's just a question of gently pulling that apart with your nails to open the ring out to free the leg from it. When you get to the larger citizines, you need to basically be dremeling these or with a diamond disc or using much heavy duty bolt croppers through because they're just too strong for these to be done. And normally then you still can't open the ring with your fingers. You need to do both sides and split it in half completely because it's too strong a material for you to open with your hand. Other very common reason for presenting a budgies, aside being sick, I guess, or some of the other clinical signs that we've mentioned, is just going to be coming in with a mass. Budgies have a lot of tumours present. If you're seeing these, then they obviously are generally a surgical thing, with histopathology being a sensible option. Masses obviously can be overtly obvious to the owner, maybe something you find by accident, or maybe something you find on suspicion of clinical presentation. And what I've basically put here is I've put a budgie here that is resting its right hind leg. The leg is being rested a little bit further forward. And this is a classical sign for renal enlargement, gonad enlargement, or a tumor in that area causing pressure on the ischiatic nerve leading to a paresis of the leg. So this sort of scenario here, you're straight on thinking about an internal mass, as well as having obviously trauma and things as your differential here, but don't rule out the possibility of internal masses in these guys leading to some of the clinical signs you're going to see. So a brief sort of view of some of the range of masses that you're going to see coming on here. This is a fibrosarcoma in the sort of tibia tarsus, musculature of an older budgie. This is another cyst forming on a wing, tightly adherent, very difficult to remove. This is a xanthoma on a distal wing, but again, lots of tissue involved here. Lipoma coming from the body wall, and this is another soft tissue sarcoma coming from the back of the head. So lots of different masses, and most of these are ultimately surgical or warrant euthanasia, depending on how the owner feels and the nature and extent of these. So I thought it's worthwhile just giving a brief run through of your approach to these in the event that you are in a situation that you have a request to deal with one of these. You need to anaesthetize your bird. Isoflurane or sevoflurane is absolutely fine for that. Listen to the heart, it'll be too fast to count. Use a little cotton bud for checking for the corneal reflex for these guys. And what we actually do with a lot of these is we'll actually have a Doppler on them that you're using for your cat blood pressures, steal that and put that on a wing. That works quite nice for getting a constant audible heart rate during anaesthesia. Now, intubation for these is ideal, very difficult. You're going to be wanting to use a 1mm ET tube, and if you don't have a 1mm ET tube, there's no need to panic. You just get a dog urinary catheter, intravenous catheter, sorry, and you can use that. You can get a 2mm syringe, cut down the 2mm syringe, and that will wedge onto a 4mm ET tube connector if you wish to do that, to get you a makeshift mini tube attachment for a small bird. Can be difficult. Budgies are hard because you've got a very thick muscular tongue. You're going to have to grab that with a very fine pair of dressing forceps, pull that forward to get access, to visualize, to get in. They are probably the most frustrating citizen to intubate, really. Having done that, we tend to mechanically ventilate them. And like I say, you can have them on capnograph now if you wanted to as well, with a Doppler, with listening to for that. And having done that, you're then basically progressing on with whatever procedures you're wishing to do to them under anaesthesia, but this sort of makes anaesthesia much safer for them. And in terms of masses, you may have very obvious abdominal masses here. So this is a sort of abdominal lipoma. We're looking at removing here. This is, I think, another abdominal mass. We're using radiosurgery here, bipolar radiosurgery, to limit blood loss, because obviously blood loss, breathing and blood loss are the two main things we're worried about here. Maybe going hypothermic as well are the three issues that we have, but obviously controlling blood loss is very, very important. And postoperatively, you want to stop the bird from chewing and damaging itself, so we use an even thin after these to suture in place to try and basically provide additional security for the surgical site, but also to limit the bird's risk of damaging it. And we're using clear plastic drapes here to insulate the bird a bit, but it also means our anaesthetist has a fighting chance of ensuring the bird isn't yet died under anaesthetic and has a reasonable chance of recovery. Just one other case to make the point for you as well, another abdominal swelling, and you think, great, okay, we can get rid of that. It feels, looks like it's quite pedunculated. You know, we can do that quite happily at this level. That's all very well and good. What you do see in the birds, what you can get is body wall ruptures, particularly in older females. And in this particular case, this mass is body wall rupture, and it's basically the oviduct has fallen into that. Quite a nasty looking oviduct has fallen into that area. So this bird is actually being spayed. Then we've got to find what's left of our body wall edges here that have gone through that hernia, or the rupture as it were, re-sew up that body wall again to reform a new body wall for them. So don't just think these are going to be easy. Sometimes they can be quite problematic. And this basically is immediate post-surgery on this bird. We've mattress sutured the skin together here, but basically we've been spayed. This is the oviduct that's come out. We left the ovary in because the risk of taking that would be too great. But this obviously is quite a big surgery to be going through, and you need to be planned for that. This is probably a bird that needs to have an IV line or an IO line placed, or certainly fluid therapy alongside that, for obviously having quite a big procedure done, which we weren't maybe anticipating at the start. Pain medication obviously is very important for these birds if you're going to end up doing lumps and bumps and things for them. So we do use opioids for them. Kappa receptors are very important in the birds. So really you're down to butorphanol or tramadol for these to have an effect. But the standard sort of buprenorphine and things we wouldn't worry with. We'd be using butorphanol or tramadol for them, which works quite okay in the sort of perisurgical period. Meloxicam is also very good. We use that routinely. It's quite sweet tasting, quite nice to be done, and that works very well. The downside you have with some of these sites is the ability to close the surgical wound, because obviously if we go back to that wing wound, for example, it's very difficult to get things to heal. You're then going to have to leave a granulating hole and allow it to do that. But obviously over time, this is that bird that had that wing mass removed, and this is sort of like 3 weeks down the road. We've got a scab forming and a granulating mass over the scab over there, and the bird is doing fine, seems to be under control with the mass being removed, and maybe has a bit better flying ability as a consequence to that. So aside from lumps and bumps and rings and beaks and nails, like I say, you may have sick birds presenting, may have obvious clinical signs of infectious agents which you're concerned about. That may be trichomonas, where you're looking at doing a crop wash. That may be obvious respiratory infection, where you're thinking of psittacosis, for example. But obviously, some of the birds come in and they just are sick. They just come in and they just look sick. Fluffing themselves up, trying to conserve body heat, this sort of type thing. But generally sitting on the floor and not looking very happy, maybe quite weak by the time they're presented to you. And we have to be aware that budgies have a high metabolic rate. What this means is they eat and drink and use this food up very, very quickly. So a sick budgie has to eat and drink. If your sick budgie becomes anorexic, that budgie will die within a very short space of time. So whereas your owners are maybe used to coming in and going, okay, great, you know, my cat's been off food for a couple of days, I think it's time I took it to the vet, because the bird continues to eat, they go, oh, the bird's eating, it must be fine, therefore I don't need to see the vet yet. The fact is it has to eat. They don't have any choice. So eating is not a sign that says, oh, that's okay, we'll leave it till the morning if the bird's still eating. That's not a positive sign, that's an act of desperation. If the owner has noticed the bird is sick, it's an emergency, full stop. So supportive nutrition obviously is something we're going to do quite a lot to these sick birds to try and get them stabilised. You know how to do the crop wash, we showed you that earlier. All you're doing now is you're going to be putting some Vetart Critical Care or Emerade Omnivore, for example, into that crop feed. You'll maybe get away with half a mil, 1 mil for a budgie, depending on how sick the bird is. And you can do that 4 or 6 times a day to start getting some calories in to the bird. We're going to weigh the bird, make sure we're able to maintain its weight. Like I say, if it's thin or in poor condition, you'll feel that clinically, and what you're looking for is to get a weight gain in the first day as you're rehydrating it and filling it up full of food, which obviously then should stabilize over the duration of the bird being hospitalized with you. And because they're fluffing up to conserve heat, then additional heat can help them quite markedly. Bird obviously on the right here is not so bad. Bird on the left is quite ill and extremis. I mean, it can't even lift up its head or even move. Serious risk of aspiration at this point, which we would be concerned about. Obviously, this is a bird on the left here that you'd be reaching for fluid therapy, and maybe then we're going to be giving that parenterally, and one of the best sites to give fluids to them parenterally will be in the skin fold between the leg and the body wall of the bird. That's quite an easy site to use. You'll get sort of half a mil of fluids in there at a time. Probably a two-person job because you're into quite a small area, and obviously you don't want to risk injecting into the body cavity because that would be instantly fatal because of that. And then with some of these cases, you might be reaching for pain relief, depending if you think there's a painful element or there's traumatic element present. But there's probably not a lot of point in terms of just randomly throwing drugs at that bird in those circumstances. Ideally, you want to be treating based on classical clinical signs for the common infections that we might see if you're going to go down that route. And obviously, having mentioned these infectious things, if it's vomiting and you're presumptively treating, maybe treating for Trichomonas or Macrorhabditis makes sense. If it's got respiratory signs, maybe treating for psittacosis makes sense, or mycoplasma. You know, there's got to be some form of logic in your options for choosing therapy. But obviously, much beyond doing that, you're down to quite limited unless you're going to start working out what is wrong with this individual and start doing some diagnostic workup. And that does depend on what the owner is going to allow you to do. And obviously, you know, we're not necessarily going to be rushing in and doing a CT assessment of every budgie that comes into the clinic. Simple things can be done first. Your crop washes and your fecal parasitology and gram staining are very, very simple things you can do virtually sort of out of a consult, really, to start looking for these more common infections to eliminate those. That's quite easy to do. But much beyond doing those, you kind of do need to be anaesthetizing the birds to try and get a diagnosis for you. Again, on a face mask is fine. If they're not having surgery, you maybe can get away with just a mask if it's very quick. But radiography is a fairly standard first port of call, looking for eggs, looking for masses, looking for a big liver, things like that going on. VD and a lateral position you'll want for these. But again, you can get some very nice useful radiographs to start the ball rolling in terms of getting a diagnosis. And if we look at this bird here, for example, not quite perfectly superimposed keel over spine, but we're not far off. We have quite marked hepatomegaly, but this is a female. We've got medullary bone in here. So we know this is a reproductively active female. This is probably hepatic lipidosis. With an active ovary, we can start dealing and treating that, for example. So your radiography is a good starting point for trying to get some answers in terms of what's happening in these birds. Blood sampling is a little bit more challenging. If you've got a bird that's 30 grams and you're worried that it is sick, then arguably you can take 0.5% of its body weight. Well, that if it's 30 grams, you're really creeping down to 0.15 mils. I can't do much with 0.15 mils. I can't do hardly anything with 0.15 mils. And even if you're going to a specialist laboratory who are used to using very small serum samples, you know, you get much below 0.4 mils, you're going to struggle to get a profile out of this. And the only real option you're going to have here is the right jugular under anaesthesia. They're too small for you to acquire blood from anywhere else, really. So when you're doing these, you need to, when you've got really low blood volume such as this, you've got to think, what is the most useful test for me? You can't just send it for a human biochem and say, there we are, let's see what comes back. Because I'll guarantee you the test you're really interested in, they won't run. So what you need to get your head around is what is most important. Now, if you're putting this straight into heparin, which you will be, then your heparin, you can do your hematology first. And what you can do, if you've got a tiny drop of blood left in your syringe, which you will have, you can use that to make a film in-house, and you can also use it to put it through a glucometer in-house as well, if you want to do a quick blood glucose on an in-house glucometer. That you can use for the drip that's left in the syringe that would be wasted. The remaining of the blood just goes straight into heparin. So hematology has to be done first, and on the right lab, used to dealing with small samples, then that's fine. And then they'll probably be able to then do some biochemistry afterwards. And this really depends on the nature of machines and how much serum the machines need as to what biochemistry they can do. Most labs, your basic biochem will be run on a standard machine. So you get your proteins, you'll get total calcium, you'll get AST and CK and uric acid on that basic machine. If you want bile acids, in a lot of cases that is a separate machine with a separate assay, and bile acids can use up quite a lot of serum. Bile acids being way preferable to AST and CK in terms of getting your liver values and liver function, but again, you may need more blood than you've got. And if you're looking at things like potassium, sodium, ionized calcium, they're normally on an iron selective electrode machine, and that also requires a separate machine to be run. So depending on what you want, you've got to decide if you think this is a bird with a big liver, this is a bird with maybe some gout going on because of the way the leg was being held and things like that, whether you've got to prioritize which ones of those you want, or whether you're thinking there is a reproductive activity and maybe you are interested in calcium in the bird. So put your list down of what your priority is on your sample for that bird. And bear in mind, once you've taken your half a mil sample, you can't really take another one for another sort of week, really, to be on the fair side for the bird. So if you want to do additional testing, like looking at Chlamydophila serology, or you're going to look at heavy metal toxicity or something else going on, you really are quite limited. You have to kind of make a decision on what I'm going to send this sample for fairly early on. So some people will, if you're going to go through and do a workup, they'll get the blood, do their x-rays, interpret the x-rays, take that alongside other clinical findings, and then decide, prioritize what tests can be most useful for them to aid their treatment of that bird based on the clinical information found so far, versus running the blood test first, just do a routine screen and then seeing what turns up. You almost want to target things a bit more. And obviously, based on what you find on that, and it's too much of a discussion for today, really, but obviously, depending on what you find, you may be taking that forward and treating the bird for gout, or treating for severe hepatic disease, or you may think there's an infection, or heavy metals, or what have you. You know, you'll start working your way through those as you end up getting your diagnosis. The only other thing worthwhile mentioning here is trauma while we're on the side of it. We do see lots of traumatic incidents involving the birds as well. This may be trauma from another bird biting off your beak. This may be trauma from you scratching because you've got a Titus externa and you're making your ear bleed. Trauma on skin, chronic scar tissue here, scratching with back feet, or again, feather plucking and damage that you can see on some birds that will start doing that as well. And again, your radiography is quite useful for determining what's going on in terms of underlying causes for that, maybe leading to those sort of changes that you could see. And I guess the other sort of final point to make on today's webinar really is that if you don't succeed in getting this bird through that, knowing how difficult it can be to confirm a diagnosis on some of these conditions in terms of the macrorhabditis and things, if you do have the opportunity to do a post-mortem, I would encourage you to do so, partly because you learn more about the cases you're seeing, but equally, if you've got a group of birds, if you're finding macrorhabditis on a post-mortem sample, then you can go back and say, okay, we're going to treat the remainder of your pet birds in order to try and get that under resolve for them as well. That is the end of today's webinar. I've got no questions today. I guess I've been quite comprehensive on my way through, on going through everything. I'm going to pass back to Emma now to finish the webinar. Thanks very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.